Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of PeopleStack Academy. Our guest for this episode is Ben Rubin, co-founder and CEO of 10% Happier. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Great, great. So why don't you start out by just telling us a little bit about 10% Happier in general and what's really exciting that's going on right now in your company?
Sure. So 10% Happier, our mission is to teach meditation to the rest of the people out there. So the sort of tagline beyond 10% Happier is meditation for fidgety skeptics. And we believe that meditation now has enough sort of scientific weight behind it that lots of people should be practicing. But the door feels kind of closed for many people who are worried about things feeling a little too new age or woo-woo or strange for them. So we're creating a way to get to meditation that is, you know, a little bit humorous, is skeptical, is scientific, and is sort of accessible to a larger amount of people.
Yeah, yeah. So what would you say to someone that, you know, I've heard about this mindfulness stuff and this meditation stuff, I'm kind of interested, but I just don't know if it's for me and I don't know how I can work it into my day. What's like one suggestion you can give to people for that?
Yeah, I mean, the simplest way to think about it is try it. And so let's, as an example, try it right now. You know, put your thumb and your finger together, your index finger, and notice the intersection point.
And you can even feel the pulse a little bit too.
Just pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Like, that's all mindfulness is. We just did it for 2 seconds. Yeah. And really, meditation is nothing other than training that focus and attention and getting lost and then coming back and then doing that again and again and again. It's like a bicep curl for the brain. And what it enables you to do is focus your attention more effectively. At least that's the start of the journey.
Right.
And that has immediate benefits in your life. So the exhortation would be try it. And also realize that in order to try it, there is nothing weird or strange or cultish that you need to do in order to get some of these benefits.
Right, right. And I think that that's one of the things that people might be, maybe scared is the wrong word, but just makes them a little bit more skeptical that, you know, I'm not that kind of person. I don't do that, you know. So I think that that's really helpful. So can you talk a little bit more about benefits to our daily lives? You know, maybe you can talk a little bit about, I know that you've been meditating for quite some time. Maybe you could talk about the benefits you've seen in your life, or if you have employees who have started meditating recently, like some really tangible stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, there are lots of different benefits, but I'll start with the one that I think resonates most with me and with others that just start the practice. And it's Dan, our co-founder, uses the term respond, not react, as sort of the one-liner for what meditation gives you. And so to parse that, you know, normally we're reacting, right? And you're quickly, when someone cuts you off in traffic, you get angry, you know, an email comes in that's not great news, you get sad. And these reactions are just triggered, and sometimes that's really negative, right? You say something that you then regret, you do something that you wish you could take back. What meditation does is it enables a little bit of time between a stimulus and a reaction that allows you to respond instead of react. So you see in the moment, I got this email, now I'm a little sad, what am I gonna do about it? Someone cut me off, I'm getting angry. Okay, what am I gonna do about that? And that little bit of space usually creates or creates more often than otherwise a different response that's a bit more helpful in terms of the way you interact with the world.
Right, right. So it can decrease road rage, for example.
Yeah. I mean, in my own life, you know, a very simple example, like I get a little less razzled by a lot of the things that happen, right? Simple example, I bike around the city. And, you know, cars are not always nice to bikers.
Really?
Yeah. It's a strange phenomenon here in Boston, but, you know, you can get cut off, people don't see you.
Yeah.
And I think I used to stew on that a lot, right? Like if someone cut me off early in a, or beeped at me or whatever, like the entire ride, I'd be kind of angry at that person.
Yeah.
Now, since I see it happening, right, the thing happens, someone, you know, beeps at me when I'm totally doing the right thing, and I get angry, but then since I see it, it I'm able to have, it dissipates a little bit more quickly and I don't get as wrapped up in it.
Yeah, so it's not about like not getting angry or not feeling stress. It's just being aware of that without it boiling over, I guess, is a way that I kind of see it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a question that's a little more, it's a little self-serving because it's something that I've always been wondering and thinking about in terms of meditation in yoga, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a question for me and all the other yoga yogis and yoginis out there. So what would you say to the person who says, I do yoga, I don't need to meditate?
Yeah. So the meditation, yoga, mindfulness, these words are, they're very distinct in terms of what they actually are, mm-hmm. but they're getting mushed together in popular culture. So I hear all the time from folks who, when they hear about meditation and mindfulness, you know, say something along the lines of like, oh yeah, I practice meditation or I'm mindful. And then they cite something that's totally not that, like yoga or running or listening to music. And mm-hmm. so I'll give you an analogy. I don't know if this one is going to make any sense, but we'll try it on. pet ownership, right? You could own a dog or a cat or a turtle. And if I said I'm a turtle owner, you wouldn't say on your side, like, oh, I love turtles too. Like my cat Ruby, you know, does X, Y, and Z and Q. Like we know these things are different in the pet category world.
Maybe in the same category.
They're in the same category of pet ownership, but they're not, owning a turtle is not the same thing as owning a cat.
Yeah.
And so yoga, meditation, mindfulness, these things are different. Mm-hmm. And we can go into a little bit the differences, right? And I think it is actually useful. The type of meditation we're talking about is a training on attention and focus on what's going on right now in the moment, training mindfulness.
Right.
And so it's that notice the, you know, the thumb and the index finger connecting. I'm noticing that. You know, yoga uses aspects of mindfulness, but is an entire physical training and mental training that I'm not even qualified to speak about, right? It's a totally different thing. Running is a totally different thing. Mindfulness can be applied to any of these activities. Mm-hmm. You can be mindful while being in traffic. You can be mindful while running. You can be mindful while doing yoga. Mm-hmm. Meditation is the training method or one of the training methods that trains mindfulness.
Right. Right. So one of the things that happens in yoga is it's the usually at the end of most yoga practices is there's a pose called Shavasana, and it basically means corpse pose. After you've gone through the 30 minutes, 90 minutes, whatever, you essentially lay on the floor like a corpse, and sometimes it's guided, sometimes it's not, and you're really just supposed to let go, listen to your breath, be aware of your body. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's, I've dabbled in meditation and I really am committed to making it a better, a more consistent part of my life. But in terms of making the connections, like when I think about, okay, what do I do when I meditate? It might be thinking about at least getting into that mindset that I'm in at the end of my yoga practice when I'm doing Shavasana.
Yeah.
So does that make sense? Does that ring true to you? They're like, oh, I do Shavasana, so that's close, right?
It's closer. It's definitely closer. It depends, I think, on how the Shavasana is led, right? I'm not a yogi, but I've participated in, I don't know, 100 yoga classes over my life, so I've seen a little bit. And, you know, I've seen sometimes basically a guided meditation that is around mindfulness during a Shavasana, where you're being asked to pay attention to specific things, be mindful in the moment. If your mind wanders, come back. But sometimes it's not guided and you're just sort of laying there. Sometimes it's guided, but it's guided in a way that is different than mindfulness meditation. So I'd say it really kind of depends on what specific instructions are being given during that period, as to whether it's a training in mindfulness or not.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that gets to the question. I think what we're kind of dancing around is sort of the how of a meditation, that there are different hows, that there are different forms of meditation. So with the 10% Happier app, is there a particular form of meditation that is taught?
Yeah, so we're speaking specifically about mindfulness meditation. So it's meditation that's meant to train mindfulness. And there's a lot more going on there, of course. But there are other styles of meditation that train things like compassion or loving kindness, that are, they're different styles of meditation.
Yeah.
our primary style is mindfulness. We do introduce other styles over time, and they're useful for different people at different moments.
Right.
But you know, think of meditation as a tool to train a skill. The tool is meditation. The skill is mindfulness.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So I've heard, like, for example, of also transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. And so what, I guess what I'm wondering about is, like, how might the experience of doing, say, a mindfulness meditation practice mm-hmm. be different from some other forms of meditation? Yeah.
So I'll give a couple examples. Mindfulness meditation, the instruction, sort of the fundamental instruction, is to pick a place, sit down, close your eyes, and pay attention to first your breath. Mm-hmm. And then if your mind wanders, come back to the breath. If your mind wanders, come back to the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And the meditation instructions advance over time to become aware of whatever's predominant. So if mm-hmm. there's a, you know, a tingling sensation and you're paying attention to the breath, pay attention to the tingling sensation. If
right.
a thought comes up, pay attention to that. If an emotion comes up, pay attention to that.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the basic progression of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, transcendental meditation, and I'm not a TM practitioner, so I can only speak to it from a sort of theoretical perspective, but is a mantra that you repeat. And as you repeat that mantra, you're focusing on that mantra.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different object of meditation. In mindfulness, we start with the breath and then expand to all objects, and whatever you become aware of is a valid object.
Right.
In transcendental meditation, at least my understanding of it as a non-practitioner, is that you focus on the mantra. So it's more of a concentration practice.
Sure.
Whereas the type that we teach starts with concentration, then expands more broadly to mindfulness. But these terms right. are very distinct, but they're related.
Yeah.
So it's not, we don't need to get too caught up in sort of all of the details. I think
sure.
any form of meditation that you practice is going to provide some sort of benefit. Again, think back to an analogy like exercise, right?
Yeah.
Running and the elliptical and strength training and CrossFit are all forms of exercise. They all benefit your physical fitness,
right.
but they're all done differently and they train something a little different, right? A long distance runner is going to have more endurance. A CrossFitter might have more power and a power lifter might be able to lift more weight.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I think it's helpful to think about, like, what do I have to do? You know, if I'm this person that's thinking, you know, I hear all this stuff about mindfulness and its benefits and meditation and its benefits, but what would it mean? How would my day look different? Mm-hmm. And as soon, the thing that clicked for me was, like, 5 minutes a day, right, I could just sit on my bed and just focus on my breath for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you just start there, that's really all it is. And then maybe you have bad thoughts or good thoughts or whatever it is. One of the things that I've found helpful when I listen to guided meditations is when people talk about the clouds. So they say, think of your thoughts as clouds and they're just there and let them pass by.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing that I really tend to connect to, is that so maybe we could shift a little bit to talk about misconceptions about meditation, is that you're not trying to quote unquote clear your mind. It's about just being aware of those thoughts and letting them go. And so that's really what made it click for me.
Yeah. And so mindfulness meditation, the goal is not to clear your mind, right? That's not the practice. It's becoming aware of whatever is happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a slight turn that one of our core teacher Joseph Goldstein uses from let it go to let it be, that he finds very useful in helping direct people towards the right way to interact with objects that come up, like thoughts, right? Because letting it go can sound like an active thing that you're trying to do. Letting it be is really the purpose of the training in mindfulness. It's to watch something and develop over time awareness mm-hmm. and a non-judgmental relationship with whatever's arising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I find that sometimes when people tell me, oh, just either let it go, or sometimes just, oh, you don't be so stressed out or whatever, it's like, that actually makes me feel worse, because it's like, I can't, what am I supposed to do? But mm-hmm. so I like that, you know, if you just sort of let it sit, let it be. I really like that. Yeah, yeah. So let's shift a little bit more to some of the misconceptions about mindfulness and meditation in particular. But I'm going to sort of lead with a question about your company here. Do folks in your company meditate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a varying level of commitment within the company. There are folks who meditate sort of aspirationally once or twice a week. They're trying to improve their practice. And there's folks like Dan who meditate 2 hours a day and go regularly on retreat.
2 hours?
2 hours a day.
Wow. So 2 hours in 7 months.
I'm at about 30 minutes a day.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Wow. And so where do you do? Do you do it at home, at work?
So I usually incorporate it into my morning routine. That's sort of the best time for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm not dogmatic about that. Sometimes I'll miss it in the morning. I'll do it in the evening.
Yeah.
If I have a big travel day, I might plan to do it on the train or on a plane. So I think having some flexibility around sort of when and how you sort of choose the time to meditate, for me at least, is a useful framework.
Yeah. So having a meditation practice is not a prerequisite for working here.
Having an interest in meditation and sort of an aspiration to have a meditation practice, I think, is the requirement. But we're very interested in, we're struggling as a company to figure out where that line is, right? Because in an ideal world, everyone who comes in would be incredibly passionate about and excited about meditation.
Right.
But, you know, where meditation is in culture today, there are not that many people who also have the very sort of technical skill sets that we need to build a tech startup that have a deep practice. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who could get into it. And so I'll give you an example. My co-founder, Derek, who, you know, is now running product for the company, has only been meditating for about a year and a half, but he's gotten really interested and excited in it. So we're looking for folks who have a predisposition and interest or an existing practice that they're going to develop.
Right. So what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions? I mean, just thinking about like your employees and the folks in the tech space in particular. I don't want to pigeonhole anyone, but it is a podcast about tech a little bit too. So I'm trying to get that in there. But I do... I've experienced some pushback from everyone, you know, in terms of like, you know, oh, you do yoga, you meditate, all of that. But what has been your experience in particular, like in terms of thinking like maybe an employee came on like, oh, I'm interested in this, but I can't do it. I don't want to do it. What have been the biggest hurdles and misconceptions?
I mean, there's a couple of big ones. You know, I think the first is around, is this something that's like weird or cultish or religious?
Yeah.
Right. And if so, I don't want to be involved in it, right? Because we've been trained, you know, certainly our generation, to be scientific, skeptical, rational. You know, in many ways, we push away from more sort of traditional structures. Sure. And so if meditation is associated with any of that, I'm out, right? And and let's be honest, like a lot of meditation that exists in the world is associated with those things, right? So the core of reality is there, that the average meditation center in the world has, you know, comes from Buddhism or Hinduism and has religious trappings around it.
Yeah.
However, the core practice is extractable from those traditions in a way that is scientific and rational and straightforward. And so I think that's sort of the first big misconception that needs to be addressed in the world.
Sure. And is there another one that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, the next that I'd mention is that many people, when they sit down to meditate, have this misconception about clearing the mind, or have this conception that when they try it, they're immediately going to be, quote, good at it. And, you know, again, sort of echoing Joseph, right, if you handed someone a musical instrument for the first time and a sheet of music and said, here's how you play these notes, they wouldn't feel like they were very good at it to start with. And it would take practice to improve their skills. Meditation is the same way, right? Mm-hmm. When you first begin to meditate, you're noticing how distracted your mind really is.
Yes.
And that's actually part of the progress, is to notice that and then gradually build more concentration, more mindfulness.
Yeah.
But a lot of people get caught up right at the beginning and they feel like they're just not good at it or they're doing it wrong, and then they stop. So the misconception there is that you're supposed to be great at it and be able to clear your mind sort of the minute you sit down, and that you're supposed to be calm and relaxed after a 5-minute guided meditation. Mm-hmm. And I think that misconception prevents a lot of people from getting past the first try.
Right, because people want to be good at what they do, you know. Yeah. So why do you work out? Like, for example, like my husband, the thing that got my husband working out was that he wants to do parkour. He wants to be awesome at parkour, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you have that goal, like I want to get stronger and more balanced so that I can be awesome at this thing. So it's like, oh yeah, let me try this meditation thing. But right, it can be extremely frustrating, especially when you may not have a lot to compare it to. I've gone through some programs where there were group meditations, and there was one of them was a 2-day program, and the very first day was a group guided meditation, and she led us through it. It was okay. It was what I would call now a more shallow meditation for myself. And at the end, she was like, "Okay, let's share. Did anybody see any colors or visions?" And I'm sitting there scratching my head. No, was I supposed to? She's like, "No, if you didn't, that's completely fine. But you know, people are saying, yeah, I saw purple or I saw a white light." And I was like, "I want to see the white light too." Yeah. But actually, what happened was the next day, I was able to get a little bit more deeper into it, and I did see like this purplish thing, and I was like, "Oh, maybe that's it." It doesn't happen a lot, but the time that it's happened has been when it's been like a guided meditation, maybe in even like a group setting, where I was already in a more relaxed state to start with. Because to me, it almost feels like playing with that line, that edge between asleep and awake. You're still awake, but that you're, you know, for me, it feels like it's like I'm on the very cusp of falling asleep. So like when you fall asleep, sometimes you start to see, you know, you start to dream. You're not that far, but I don't know. That's what it feels like for me anyway.
I'd say maybe you're just tired.
I was going to ask you, what's your professional opinion on that? Right. Yeah.
I'd say a mindful state is actually more alert and awake than maybe we are in our everyday experience.
Interesting.
I think actually many people are tired when they close their eyes and get quiet.
Yep.
You know, that comes to the fore. So you may be experiencing some of that. Mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, there's also a misconception. So if the first misconception was around, like, do I have to join anything? Is this some weird cult? And the second one was around, am I failing, right? Yeah. Do I have to clear the mind? Yeah. The next one is that meditation is supposed to be somehow relaxing and calming.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that, yes, there are benefits to meditation that relate to stress, and some meditation styles can cause an occasion relaxation and calming, but fundamentally mindfulness meditation is about noticing whatever comes up.
Interesting.
So it's not about trying to get to a special state of calm or relaxation. Mm-hmm. It's about noticing the sleepiness, noticing the anger, noticing the frustration, noticing the calm.
Yeah.
And so it takes some understanding and some practice to get to a place where you are practicing in a way where you're not expecting or trying to create certain circumstances, and if you think that those aren't arising, you think you're doing it wrong.
I could totally see that. Yeah, and so, yeah, I totally can relate to that. Maybe I'm just falling asleep because I think part of it is I'm a napper and I love taking naps in the middle of the day. Yep. So maybe it's almost just like my body thinking, oh, it's time for a nap now, mm-hmm. when really no, it's not. You're saying it's actually quite the opposite. But yeah, I could see how practice can help get you there. So let's shift again slightly to think about the workplace, and thinking about given all of these misconceptions and the fidgetiness of people and the skepticalness of people. I think one of the ways that we can really get this integrated into the workplace is to make it more practical. And not like, as you were saying, it has nothing to do with religion or woo-woo or whatever it is. And so I'm wondering if you've thought about that at all, or have tried to integrate it, like group meditation at your workplace or whatever.
Yeah. So first of all, let me talk about a benefit of meditation that's sort of super relevant for tech companies, and it's focus, right? We as a society are very good at fragmenting our attention, and the smartphone, which is what we use to deliver our meditation, ironically, is a tool that is used to fragment attention very well. So you open up your phone in a, you're a moment of boredom or restlessness or unhappiness and are immediately either on Facebook or Twitter or Reddit or like pick your poison, some little game, mm-hmm. You know, jumping between news items or, you know, on a news feed, that fragmenting of attention leads to fragmenting of attention during the workday, right? So sitting down and getting a project done or spending an hour on a meeting becomes harder if you're fragmenting your attention regularly using technology. So yeah. Meditation, to a certain extent, is the antidote to that, right? It's a training in focus and attention so that when you sit down to do a project, you're able to sustain attention on it for a longer period of time mm-hmm. and more effectively do your job. So I'd say first, there's like a very practical reason that's like related to your productivity at work.
Yeah.
In terms of how do you incorporate it into a workday, you know, this is something that I don't think we've figured out yet, right? I think I don't see a world in which, you know, there's long stretches of silence before meetings and we're talking about being heart-centered and, you know, the whole woo-woo new age aspect of meditation, I don't think is ever going to make its way into the workplace. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the question is how do you encourage personal practice? And then how do you bring really small moments of mindfulness into mm-hmm. a meeting or an interaction or sitting at your desk? And that's something that we've, I think, not yet figured out as a company.
Yeah, I like the small moments of mindfulness during a meeting. So I could see that being really practical, like a course on or a workshop or something like that. I've seen workshops and courses out there on like how to run meetings better. Right. So is there a way to incorporate, you know, just kind of throwing the question out there to the world, is there a way to incorporate aspects of mindfulness into our meeting planning, into our meeting, the way that we run meetings and into our follow up and things like that? Are there things that the meeting planner and like the leader,
yeah. you know,
so this could be a leadership skill, right, that can do, you know, here's a 5-step process so that during that meeting, it results in higher focus, higher productivity, getting more yeah. done because of it.
I hope someone's yeah. thinking about that
yeah.
and, or has thought about it and will reach out and point us in the direction of that, because I think that's a really nice way to maybe introduce mindfulness to yeah. a larger group of folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the context that is business-oriented and productivity-oriented and sort of not scary
yes.
for folks, I think that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, cool. So we have a little bit more time. I'm going to ask, I ask most of my podcast guests this, especially the folks who are leaders in tech companies, because I focus on essentially creating a better people stack. If you think of the people stack as the analogy to the tech stack, you know, so every tech company needs tech stack. It's the bit of cool toys and processes and software that makes a tech company go. Well, you need a people stack as well. You need people processes. How do you hire? How do you give feedback? How do you train leaders? How do you train in general? You know, so it's stuff like that. So what would you say at 10% Happier is your biggest hurdle in terms of people processes?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a pretty high growth phase right now, and it means that we're hiring. And I'd say the biggest challenge is the boundary between hiring the absolute perfect person who you're absolutely confident can do the job and you're unlimitedly excited about, and holding yourself either to that standard or not to that standard. Because set to an extreme, it's impossible to find the perfect person with the perfect experience who's a perfect fit for the culture every time for every job. Mm-hmm. And yet if you sacrifice too much or if you sacrifice along the wrong vectors,
right.
the company doesn't make progress. So the that interplay between perfect person for the job versus right enough and can be trained into you know, areas of weakness, that's an area that I think we've not figured out quite yet. And there have been moments in, you know, my professional history where I've swung too far in one direction or the other, and I'm always looking for the right balance.
Yeah. And it's the way that I see that is sort of like the buy, build pendulum, that sometimes you're at a point where you want to quote unquote buy the talent. I've never, I heard that somewhere else. I've never really liked it because I don't like the idea of like making people sound like things that we buy. But anyway, it's easy to say buy versus build, that you're basically investing in your hiring process and mm-hmm. you're trying to get it as perfect as possible versus the building, right? So that's the training and that kind of stuff that we need a bunch of people right now. We need three new engineers like yesterday, right? So you hire the best that you can find, the best for now, the good enough for now, and then you invest resources into training them.
Yeah, I've heard, I recently read an article written by Keith Raboy, who's at a venture firm and was at Square and PayPal and some other big companies, that generally when you identify the perfect person for the job, you either can't afford them or can't get to them, right? It's like everyone wants the shortstop who bats 350 and has X number of RBIs, but you all know there's only two people in the league who have done that. So your job really as a startup founder or a team builder mm-hmm. is finding people who have that potential and then developing it. And that's an incredibly challenging find and skill set to have, is finding that talent and then training them.
To be able to identify the high potentials, right? It's like a crystal ball. It's like, okay, if I were to hire you, what are you going to do?
Right.
And it's sort of seeing into that crystal ball and pinpointing, like really dialing in to what are the things that matter here? And actually that relates to, I was reading through some of MassTLC's stuff, and they interviewed you before the NewCo Festival, and they asked you a wonderful question, which was, what did you miss in the interview for your worst hire you ever made? And your response was lack of inclination to take true ownership. And I think that's so key. So have you guys figured that out yet? Working on it?
Yeah, I think we've worked on it, right? So the hires I've made that didn't really incline towards true ownership, right? When it push came to shove, they weren't the ones who were going to go fix stuff. They were going to look around and see what was the problem in some other area of the organization or throw up their hands. And that's not what you need in a startup and an early stage company. Yeah. So we've put in place, I think, some good cultural traits and interview processes that help. Yeah. So specifically, we've started to look for what we call make awesome stuff mentality. And make awesome stuff means, in someone's background, in their history, are they talking about naturally something they've done or built that is incredibly awesome and that they've honed and perfected and made to be awesome or not? And it actually is remarkable, the split that happens, right? You'll hear from some candidates who, were in this amazing teaching program and they built this tool and they built that tool and then the students had this amazing outcome. And then there's other folks who, when push comes to shove, there's nothing that they've done that they're truly proud of. And I think that's an interesting indication of whether someone has the chops to take ownership mm-hmm. and drive something to amazing, right? Yeah. Have they done that either in their personal or professional career, in their school career, in the past?
Right. So have you seen, as you've started asking these questions to get at the, have you built an awesome thing that you're proud of, hire those people and seen how they're performing better?
I don't think we've gotten far enough to go through that cycle again. I mean, certainly the folks that we've hired have met that criteria.
Yeah.
And, it's still early, but indications are good.
That's great. And so my thing is just in terms of spreading the knowledge around the world about hiring and how we hire better is just to make sure you close the loop, right? So if you develop these great set of interview questions that get in some really awesome people who have previously created an awesome project, right? And now it's, okay, is this actually working? So to also develop some sort of measures or metrics or whatever works within your culture to figure out, okay, did this actually work? Or where do we, and it helps you identify where you need to tweak too.
Yeah, and that's incredibly hard in a small company, right? Because you just have so little data. And so I'm hoping that there are big companies that are honing these processes. Yep. And in fact, when I read books about hiring or interview processes, a lot of that comes from the Googles of the world who have tens of thousands of employees and actually are able to, in a methodological way, measure the outcome of some of their interview processes. Mm-hmm. So, given the size of the company, a lot of it ends up being anecdotal. And usually, again, it's very binary. Either someone is incredible for the organization,
yep,
or they're pretty terrible.
Yeah. And it could be as simple as that. I mean, you don't need as much data as Google has. I mean, I've heard Googlers say, we don't need this much data. Like, they've gone from like a 14-point scale down to a 7-point scale, like a Likert scale, like, and that's a good thing for them. Mm. It could be a 2-point scale, right? It could just be writing in a notepad or an Evernote or whatever you use or whatever it is to say, okay, did this person work out, yes or no?
Yeah.
If this person didn't work out, and just kind of tracking back, okay, what questions did we ask them? And just kind of documenting.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you don't have the support that the Googles of the world have. So does that seem to be like the biggest hurdle? You said, because you're a small company, right? So is it that you need engineers, right? You need marketing people. And so when people are like, oh, you need to hire an HR person, then that becomes like, oh, we can't afford that. Is that kind of like the hurdle to collecting data?
Yeah, I think it's just the number of hires you make and how long the cycle time is to know whether they're good or not and how long you have as a startup, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in the next, I don't know, 18 months, we might make 10, 15, 20 hires, and the company will either be massively successful or out of business within 24 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, the number of people who are hired and then we saw the outcome, mm-hmm, and then tying those back to any sort of numerical significance,
yeah,
is just not big enough.
Right, right. In order to do like statistical analyses and stuff like that, trust me, I'm a stats geek. I love working with data and running analyses where you can actually potentially show statistical significance.
Yeah.
But in recent years, I've pushed back from that for many reasons.
Yeah.
There's this whole big data thing out there, right? I'm a small data person, right? Even just one case study. It was kind of like the case study approach. Like if you have one case study, you're like, this person was an awesome hire and look at all this awesome stuff that they did,
yep,
that you can then just take, even if it's anecdotal, right? You don't need to prove anything, but it's better to have the information versus not.
Yeah. I'd say if there's one thing I've learned about hiring, it's something that's actually built into every culture that I've been a part of as a company. It's that people who are on a self-improvement, personal development, being a better person path.
Yeah.
Those are the folks that are on the type of trajectory that could help you identify someone early who's going to be incredible in their,
mm-hmm,
role.
Mm-hmm.
And so we look for that as well. And mindfulness and meditation is a part of that. It's not the only tool.
Right.
In fact, it's one of many. But I think that's another important thing that I've learned along the way is, you know, yeah, is someone actively trying to hone their craft, improve their life, become a better person, or not? And where are they on that scale? And again, that can be fairly binary.
Yeah, and that's why companies might ask questions like, who's your favorite author? Or who do you follow online? Mm-hmm. It's to sort of get into that. First of all, can you even name someone?
Yep.
And then second of all, how much do you know about this person? How much did you learn about this person? So that can be a way to kind of get at that.
Like
that's
that.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. So we're almost up on time. So I have one final question, sort of the big, if you had one piece of advice question. So if you had one piece of advice to give to people who've listened to this podcast and are saying, okay, I want to try meditation now, what would be your advice to them for first steps?
Think back to your physical exercise. And my guess is if you're listening to this podcast and you have some inclination to improve yourself, your life, physical exercise is probably a part of your life and it's probably improving your life in some way. And even if you're aspirational about, I wish I was doing whatever my physical exercise practice was more, mm-hmm, you've seen the benefits. Meditation is a form of mental exercise. And so I think it could be, and it's been shown to be as powerful as physical exercise. So prioritize trying it in some way, right? And again, like physical exercise, there's lots of different modalities that you know, what you gravitate to will depend on who you are and what your community is. And meditation, you know, can also be done within specific religious traditions like Christianity and Judaism. But look for some form of mental training that helps you develop the capacities around mindfulness and compassion and concentration that lead to you being a happier, better person that's going to be worth your investment in time.
Excellent. And how can people check out your app if they, where can they find it?
Yeah, they can find it either in the App Store, just search for 10% Happier, or on the web, 10percenthappier.com.
Excellent. Great. So it was wonderful talking with you, Ben.
Thanks.
Okay. Take care.
And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Check out my website, jenbunk.com. That's J-E-N bunk.com, where you can find lots of goodies, including a link to PeopleStack Academy, my online school dedicated to helping the tech community build better people processes. Also on genbunk.com, you can sign up for the Change Log, the PeopleStack weekly email with tips and exclusive offers only available to my email tribe. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.